All right, so good morning. I'm going to talk about exciting properties of RNA nanostructures. First, of course, I would like to thank the organizers for organizing this interdisciplinary workshop. And because this is sort of the interdisciplinary workshop, I guess I will have to do quite some explaining to do what I'm going to talk about. I'm in Max from M2NET lab at Wilfrid Laurier University, and Bruce is from Center for Cancer Research at the Nanobiology Program in Maryland. So the first question we need to answer, what basically is RNA nanostructure? Why do we need it for? And basically, the main motivation here is that we would like to construct and understand better nanoscale delivery tools that can scaffold and carry anti-cancer therapeutic agents directly to infected cells. And basically, the area that I'm sort of covering here is essentially design of bio-nanostructures, and specifically, I'm going to focus here on RNA. There is a terminology, basically, in the literature that you could find. People are talking about RNA architectonics, which essentially means that we are talking about a set of recipes for self-assembly of the RNA nanostructures of the arbitrary size and shape. So basically, what we're talking about here is that we could use RNA building blocks, such as right angle motif, kinturn motif, and specifically I'm going to talk about RNA1, RNA2 complexes, And these building blocks can be manipulated either experimentally or via computational experiments into the desired 2D or 3D nanostructures, such as squares, hexagons, cubes, so basically two-dimensional structures like square hexagons, or three-dimensional structures like cube and tetrahedrons. And then they can further be assembled into periodic and quasi-periodic lattices. The characteristic dimensions of structures that I'm going to talk about is sort of between 10 nanometers and 50 nanometers. And I'll try to explain also the reason why, you know, these characteristic dimensions are going to be of this size. So why to use RNA nanostructures? Of course, you would find a lot of literature related, for example, to DNA nanostructure. And what is special about RNA nanostructure? First of all, RNA is a promising alternative to DNA and proteins for artificial self-assembled nanomaterials because of a number of reasons that are listed basically here. RNA has a much greater variety of interactions compared to DNA. For example, there is a noticeable presence of the non-Watson-Crick base pairing. Also, RNA shows much larger structural modularity and diversity of the tertiary structural building blocks, which is sort of makes them similar to proteins, but if you compare to DNA, it's basically on the order of magnitude higher. And also, RNA shows great conformational flexibility, which is essentially already used by nature via catalytic function of RNA. Which basically all these factors make RNA a unique functional nanomaterial. Kind of to summarize, if you like, you sort of have a level of simplicity in some way that is present in DNA, but also you have structural and functional versatility, which is more typical for proteins. Now, the type of applications that most probably important, at least at the present day, for RNA nanostructures is essentially scaffolding, drug delivery, and ultimately a sort of combination of these two functions. So ultimately, we want to build therapeutic RNAs on the RNA scaffolding, basically creating a single all-RNA nanostructure. So all basically components would consist of RNA, both sort of house for this therapeutic agent and the agent itself. So now, when we're talking about RNA nanoparticles for drug delivery, of course, It's an important issue because we know that one of the major problems in treatment of diseases such as cancer is the delivery of the drug exactly to the desired site or cell. And this problem is fundamental problem, has not been solved, of course, as we know. But probably RNA-based nanoparticles could be an ideal solution for this. And there are a number of reasons for that. For example, nanoscale objects smaller than 50-100 nanometers can easily enter most cells. But those that are smaller, say 10-20 nanometers, can move out of blood vessels and they circulate as they circulate through the body. Of course, there are a number of crucial issues that need to be addressed. One is the efficient attachment of drugs, and this is part of the story that I'm going to tell you, because one of the major applications that sort of we target is scaffolding of these RNA nanostructures, so where to host these RNA nanostructures when you're going to deliver the drugs. The other issue, of course, controlled drug release, and a number of other things like size, toxicity, biodegradability, properties, and activities of the nanoparticles. And essentially, a larger proportion of my talk would be related to properties, because if you would like to use these materials, we need to know, you know, as much as we can about these RNA nanostructures. So, now, why to use RNA to deliver drugs as opposed to other technologies that are already existing? Well, what you could do, you could think of RNA as a vehicle. Essentially, it is protein-free RNA that could induce a minimal immune response and therefore reduce antibody production in the cell. RNA is considered as the novel and promising therapeutic agent. For example, small interferon RNA can down-regulate genes responsible for cancer and for a number of other diseases. And I already mentioned these all RNA nanoparticles. Essentially what it means that different kinds of therapeutic RNA built onto their RNA scaffolding. And they could be especially useful for treatment of cancer and a number of other things. Again, there are a number of challenges that needs to be taken into account in dealing with RNA nanoparticles, such as stability in the blood, and some authors also quote nonspecific cellular intake. Now, if I'm talking about this small interferon RNA, now, I have to admit that basically most of talks that I've been given in the past are essentially related to sort of PDE, because I'm sort of PDE guy as well. But in this specific talk, you would see not more than one PDE. Although I sort of mentioned some tools here, and specifically, for example, if you're talking about a small interfering RNA, and we would like to describe for example, RNA silencing pathway, we could sort of draw the following diagram, which is not necessarily always the same, because this RNA silencing pathway is different if you consider, for example, plant cells, or you can see the human cells, or you can see the bacterial. But the essence of the story pretty much the same. This is typical RNA silencing pathway. And basically what we did as a sort of spin-off of this project, we wrote down a system of coupled nonlinear differential equations with respect to the concentration of messenger RNA. This D is double-stranded RNA, this small interferon RNA, and garbage RNA. Also, as a function of these two major parameters with respect to which we studied this system. I'm not going to show you the system, but as I said, it's a system of coupled nonlinear differential equations. And what you could do based on this system, you could sort of analyze and try to understand predict the time within which gene silencing will be activated. And how you do that, you essentially could construct certain sort of bifurcation diagrams. The first diagram is essentially plotted with respect to this parameter, GA. Well, other parameters that you see here is essentially rates and sort of parameters with respect to which you are trying to analyze the model. So the first verification diagram that you see on the next slide is with respect to this parameter, and the second one with respect to GP. I wouldn't go too much details. The next question basically that you may want to ask is how actually this small interfering RNA could be delivered. In the past, basically, there have been experimental studies related to RNA nanoparticles in cancer treatment. And one of the prominent examples is due to Gur, who published a number of papers related to that. Specifically, what he did, he basically started so-called pRNA, which he used and his team used for the construction of nanoparticle vesicle used to deliver this small interfering RNA that I've just been talking about, how you could model their silence and pathway, and receptor binding aptamers, they demonstrated that they can block cancer development in cell cultures in living mice. And specifically, he also even showed that it is true for human cells, in particular breast cancer cells. Now, the nanostructures basically that you see here, it's what we call essentially molecule-based bio-nanostructure design. Because there are three different RNAs are essentially present in this structure. And I'll just give you characteristic dimension. This is, as you see, sort of triangular, basically, we can look at. This example, previous example of Duro, he's basically experimentalist. But what I'm going to talk about mainly is a computational alternative as a sort of exceedingly attractive goal in modeling RNA nanostructure. And of course, there are a number of reasons for that. And as I mentioned, there are two types of design of self-assembled RNA nanostructure. One is molecule-based. Essentially, what you do, you pick up specific molecules to design your nanostructure, but then, of course, shape is dictated by the specific molecule that you have chosen. Or it could be shape-based, where building blocks are chosen based on desired shape. And essentially, most experimentalists are essentially within this sort of category. Some of them also in this category, but computational sort of tools that I'm going to describe are essentially related to shape-based design of bio-nanoparticles. There are a number of reasons why it's quite important to use computational tools in the area. First of all, design of nanoparticles and nanostructure can greatly benefit from the detailed understanding and predictability of the molecular interactions, and specifically between various molecular components within the structure. It will lead to a better rate of success for the nanoparticle usage. Now, our focus up until now has been on specific RNA nanostructure, so-called RNA hexaring. It's not something that has been around for a long time. It's basically Bruce and Yingling published a paper in NanoLetters just a year ago, and we focus here on one specific example, so-called hexagon-shaped RNA nanorings. Essentially, this hexaring composed of six RNA1, RNA2 complexes, and this is basically a typical representation that you see. The structure here is solvated in a water box, which we do not show here, together with magnesium ions, which are represented here by green spheres. And the size of the nanostructure that we are dealing with is essentially around 15 nanometers. Okay? So this is the key structure that we focus and we are trying to study. You see, it's not sort of an easy structure to deal with. And also, as I said, sort of, you know, most of my life I've been working with sort of continuum mechanics-based model, but as you could understand, it's not easy to deduce something here for structure like that, at least to get an initial sort of insight into how the structure behaves under different conditions. Now, it's not old story because I would like to mention something else. Now, I think 1996, many people quote as the first paper where people successfully model RNA nanostructure with a simple hairpin, including free energy function and things like that. Now, this structure is much more difficult than just the simple hairpin, and already back then, you know, 10 years back, people understood that essentially loops create problems. Although they are fairly stable, but they create problems in modeling, especially if you take into account water, if you take into account the ions, and sort of you approach yourself to a realistic situation. Now, in the structure that I'm talking about, as sort of you see this complete structure, but as I mentioned here, it consists of six complexes of like this. And what's happening here that, you know, the connection between this RNA 1, RNA 2 is called kissing loop. And this kissing loop sort of is magnified here. And this is essentially, as I said, interactions between these two parts of the complexes. It's fairly stable, and this bending angle is around 120 degrees. Now, why it is important in principle to consider these RNA hexarings? Because it has a number of pretty good properties. First of all, these interactions specific to this kissing loop could be easily adjusted, for example, by binding counter ions. That's essentially where we focus, but you could also consider proteins or RNA, so-called one-modulator. Also, the size of the hexaring can easily be manipulated by incorporating extra helical turns. Now, if you can see the middle of each hexagon side, they can be used effectively to attach different components for cell recognition, including what I was mentioning before, a small interfering RNA, but also, for example, you know, things like quantum dots. Now, still, the structure that I'm talking here, although it's three-dimensional structure, you know, it's not complete, you know, scaffold that you may want to use. But what you could do, you could sort of multiply this structure. So if you go back to my hexaring, like here, so what you do, you essentially link this structure to a number of other. And what you obtain as a result, you would obtain RNA essentially, not nanorings, but RNA nanotubes. And this is sort of another thing that we just started looking at, but we have to understand first, of course, this RNA ring before moving to this small complex structure. And again, there is a hope, again, that if you understand this ring well, right, we probably could use some sort of averaging procedure and can try to extract some useful properties already for this very complicated structure. And again, the diameter of the structure, because of the design that I mentioned, it's sort of the same as my nanoring. Okay, so what I'm after here is I would like to study mechanical and thermodynamic properties of this RNA hexaring, focusing on the following main issue. Of course, everyone is interested in stability of this hexaring, for example, as a function of temperature. Effect of the environment, you know, how important is water, how important, not necessarily water, but probably some physiological solution if you put it into the blood. Counter ions, how important counter ions here. You would like to know behavior of the hexaring and the external forcing. And from this, you could extract essentially mechanical elastic transport property of structures like that. And ultimately, also, we would like to know the mechanism of the assembly of the hexagonal ring structure starting from its building block, which is sort of much more complex task to do. Now, in the end of my talk, I also, will try to elaborate on perspectives for development of satisfactory realistic coarse-grained models for the RNA hexaring, and I explain why it is needed, and it is really one of the key issues in this area. And again, I'll try to explain you why. Now, the model here. It's as I said, you have to take into account basically practically everything. So what you have to do full atom molecular dynamic simulation, which we do via Langevin method. So we take into account damping, apply it external force, and we also use here Gaussian fluctuations, Gaussian random force. This damping parameter that is here, I'm going to talk about later. Soon. And applied external force, as I said, is the way how we're going to derive elastic, for example, properties for this structure. Now, implementation of the model. First of all, again, I would like to mention briefly that applying molecular dynamics to nucleic acid systems with water and ions is challenging. Now, let alone that in contrast to protein systems, even succeeding to generate stable molecular dynamic trajectories for RNA systems like this is fairly difficult. And you will see also some examples related to that. For full atom molecular dynamic simulations, we use NAMD package with the CHARM 27 force field, and visualization is essentially done via VMD. Now, this is further technical details that if some of you are interested, I could sort of provide. But probably one of the things that you would like sort of to know. Briefly is that this hexarine is solvated in this number of water atoms, and we use either 330 natrium or 165 magnesium ions, essentially randomly added to the box in order to neutralize 330 phosphates from which essentially this complex consists of. And also, as I said, we would like to be fairly realistic in what we are doing. So basically, we can see the different cases, different physiological solution based on different concentration of these counter ions. And this is sort of time-stepping details and other things that are given here. The first thing was quite encouraging, because what we've done here, we performed simulation, essentially about 2 nanosecond simulation, and it was sufficient for ions absorption onto the ring. But of course, it's sort of pretty close already to steady state, as you see. But of course, it fluctuates because there are a number of other sort of slower processes, for example, migration of the ions along the ring, structural change in the ring, and other things. But what also is interesting, I mean, two experiments have been performed, two temperatures were chosen, 510 and 310. Basically, in most of the experiments that we've been doing, and examples here in the picture are given for the presence of natrium counter ions. And essentially, what is presented here is a root mean square deviation from the initial structure. So the energy of interactions RNA ions and the number of ions found within 5 angstrom of RNA as a function of time for the structure like that. So this is quite encouraging. But the next step that we did, which was quite interesting, we've done also a quench experiment, which means that basically first RNA ring equilibrated at 510, because you've seen on the previous picture that basically the behavior is pretty good for both temperature, 510 and 310. So what you could do, you could equilibrate at 510, and then you can quench to 310 degrees. And what would you observe in the situation like this is quite interesting phenomenon. This leads to ions evaporation from the ring into the solution. And you would observe this phenomenon for both, for magnesium and natrium ions. An example in this picture is essentially is given for magnesium. And we present only magnesium atoms that had been located as before within 5 angstrom of RNA nanorings. So the question is, how are you going to explain this? And what we were trying to explain this phenomena, so we sort of were trying to analyze that with different sort of interaction energy RNA ions curves. It's a little bit sort of busy curve, but the essence here that again we plotted this root mean square deviation from the initial structure for the energy of interaction RNA ions and a number of other characteristics. So basically dotted lines like this or like this, represents the situation when initial structure was equilibrated at 510 for dotted lines, and for solid lines it's essentially configuration is 310 as shown. Now these curves, if you look at them first time, I mean you probably would not extract sort of much information, but here is the summary after the analysis that we've done. So what you would see here after the analysis is that at higher temperature, the ring takes up more ions. For example, 0.8 natrium perphosphate or 0.88 magnesium per 2 phosphate, as compared to 310 degrees where we have a respective value 0.6, 0.66. So basically, the phenomenon that we observed is essentially what we called self-stabilization of the ring under increasing temperature by taking up more ions. So if you like, this is a certain self-defense mechanism, and of course we would like to explain this. The first thing comes into mind is essentially mining condensation theory. But you cannot apply here the theory, strictly speaking, because it has been developed essentially for straight wire. And here you're talking about the ring, so geometry is very different. But the other thing is also the ring thickness is comparable to the biolayers of the solution in our case, which is again was a very simplified assumption for the mining theory. You cannot sort of apply that. Also, you could easily observe that if you use very simple models try to explain this phenomenon, like von Hoff equation, again the behavior seemingly contradicts to this simple model behavior. So the question is, we want a sound explanation of this phenomenon. The first sort of thing to explore, maybe thermal expansion or contraction of the ring is responsible for this phenomenon. But you would observe, again after the analysis, that between 510 and 310, the ring contracts about 5%, and in terms of volume, it would correspond to 10-15%. However, the percentage of ions evaporated is much higher compared to that. So this is probably not a good explanation. Now, other hypotheses that you may want to explore is a structural change in the RNA ring with temperature, which is possibly could be related to hydration. And there is, of course, a reason to explore this hypothesis, because the changes of the hydration state of the solutes, in particular biological ones, are known to modify also their solubility properties. So this is the next thing that we essentially were trying to do. So this part of the story is related to the analysis of the environments of ions near RNA nanostructure. And in this picture, essentially, what you see radial distribution functions on both of these figures for different magnesium pairs, so-called P pairs and here O pairs. Again, this is the structure for 165 magnesium ions, Belling intralayer system. What you observe, you would not observe chelated magnesium ions at 310 temperature. You would observe very few, namely 3 out of 165 in 510 runs. And after you quench essentially the structure from 510 to 310. Basically could see on both of these pictures two peaks associated with hydrated magnesium ions. which are quite visible. Now, the next thing that you could do, you could integrate these curves, essentially. The reason, basically, you would see, this is essentially the distance of the proximity of your ions to the nanorings. You would observe that chelated magnesium ions do not contribute significantly to the picture. The overall decrease of ions around RNA is due to the decrease of hydrated magnesium. So if you like, this is... Now, we've done the same essentially for natrium counter-anion ions. We observed that most of natrium ions are chelated. The overall decrease of ions around RNA is due to the decrease of both chelated and hydrated natrium. This is finally, we also were trying to have a look at the physiological solutions that I've been mentioning before to see whether our analysis for the simpler situation would still hold for these physiological solutions as well. What we found, basically, that chelated magnesium ions are present in the situation of both 310 and 510 runs. We observed 7 out of 415. However, they do not contribute significantly to the evaporation of ions upon quench. The overall decrease of ions around RNA is due to the decrease of hydrated magnesium. Now, just one more thing here before I proceed. Here is basically, again, radial distribution function for PP pairs at different concentration of magnesium and natrium and different temperature. 310, 510, and then quench situation as I described before. What you observe here is quite interesting things that basically you would observe shift or peak shift towards smaller distances at high temperature, and basically the reverse process shifting back to larger distances upon quenching. So after we analyzed this situation, we concluded the following, that based on this radial distribution function analysis, in particular the observation that peaks for PP pairs become shifted towards the smaller distances at high temperature, we conclude that phosphates become on average closer to each other upon the temperature increase. Now, from this, you will conclude that essentially it means that the RNA charge density effectively increases for the nanoring. And if you use, again, some previous literature a guide to ions and RNA nanostructure by Draper, this should in principle result in a higher uptake of ions, which basically could be quite sound explanation what we observed. Now, if I would like to analyze elastic properties, we are going to apply external forces. So in order to estimate elastic properties of the ring, its transport property, for example, mobility in the water, we apply external force into the ring. So how do we do that? Basically, our major experimental setup is based on applying radial compressive or expansive constant force to all of the atoms belonging to the nucleic backbone. Here what we did first. Force is applied to the nucleic backbone in order to extract some information on elastic property. And what we did, we apply such force that it slowly increases from zero by the increment of 0.1 angstrom per picosecond squared, the subsequent relaxation time of the ring during 100 picosecond. What you see in this picture is essentially gyration radius of the RNA hexa ring as a function of time. And what you see here, two things. First of all, you see that no equilibration is achieved, which is not that good news. On the other hand, you sort of see a parabolic type of dependency of this gyration radius. So based on that, you already sort of could try to extract some useful information. This is basically just to demonstrate to you briefly what is going to happen. First, it's sort of fairly slow, when you apply these radial forces. But then you would see that it's quicker and quicker sort of would collapse as this, for example, to tangling ends approaching each other. And that's basically what is happening. Yeah, and this is just repetition. So now, okay. As I said, even based on this not fully equilibrated structure, but the observation that essentially you have this parabolic dependency, you already can extract some useful information. So parabolic dependency, under the application of strong forces, just to give you some, basically the force increment here are on the order of picanewtons. And just to give you sort of comparison, single hydrogen bond breakage force is around 0.3 picanewton, while typical forces for RNA unfolding are much higher, 1,000 picanewton. So basically you do very simple analysis to evaluate effective damping coefficients for different temperatures, 310 degrees, for example, or 510 degrees. You could extract the information. And based on essentially Arrhenius slope, you could also extract the information on the viscosity activation energy, which is in this case around 430 degrees. So all this seemingly makes sense. And also what we are trying to do a sort of longer annealing experiment in our analysis, namely we use 1 nanosecond annealing, basically it's seemingly at the same force, however we apply here constant force. Remember that in the first type of experiment we apply stepwise forcing, whereas here just a larger force. And again we evaluated the effective damping and the viscosity activation energy, and again this is a sort of reasonable value. But the question still here, applying still smaller forces in full molecular dynamics, of course, it would require much longer annealing times. So is there any way out of the situation like this? And of course, we would like to see whether the configurations obtained at this high force can be used to estimate elastic properties via this parabolic energy strain dependencies. So what we did, we apply still higher force and sort of plotted energies of the hexarink as a function of gyration radius for the set of configuration generated at high force. And sort of you would observe that these dependencies are not parabolic but rather linear. So the conclusion here could be either the configuration generated under this high force are not representative of equilibrium, or most likely some plasticity involved. But in principle, to answer this question very conclusively, of course you need much longer simulation time on the order of microseconds rather than nanoseconds as we do that. So the question is, can this be achieved with the coarse grain model? If you would like to estimate elastic properties, you can do that. Basically, longest of our run, 2 nanoseconds, annealing under this applied force, which is less than needed to break hydrogen bonds in our setup. What you would observe somewhere around here, this value and this value, you observe that sort of metastable plateau visible where system spans quite some time. And you could give a lower bound for that, is 1.3 angstrom. And therefore, upper bound for the elastic coefficient, sort of as an analog of two-dimensional bulk modulus, could be evaluated, and this is evaluated here. Now, if you translate it into three-dimensional sort of situation, you could divide this value that you extracted by thickness of the ring, which is 30 angstrom, and you obtain value like this. In the literature, what we found, this is gigapascal. In the literature, what you would find that DNA, for example, Young modulus is around 0.5, so this is substantially smaller. What other properties? You could evaluate heat capacity based on the energy fluctuation. But of course, there are again here a number of difficulties, experimental and computational. Energy dependency still shows systematic drift that affect the estimations. And again, it's not clear completely how ionic subsystems that closely interacting with may closely interact with RNA ring should be included. But initial estimates would show you that heat capacity at 310 is like this. Which is much higher compared, for example, to the water. Now, you would say, is this too big? Now, the good thing is that if you try to evaluate this heat capacity at 510, it is estimated 3-5 times smaller. Therefore, energy fluctuations relative to temperature are smaller. And it may give additional support of our idea of self-stabilization of the ring due to the higher ions intake. Now, the final thing when we discussed this, all of us, with Bruce said that basically it's a good idea also to check whether helicity assumption is essentially preserved on the Langevin dynamic. And the other option, what you could do, you could try to run a Benson dynamics, a full atom molecular dynamics simulation. And essentially, we've done that and sort of analyzed the situation, and our conclusion was that the Langevin does not seem to affect helicity, while if you use Berenson dynamics, it will affect. But of course, Berenson is a rough method of the temperature control. There is no big surprise here, but this is sort of double check that the helicity assumption is preserved. Discussion in outlook of this full molecular dynamics lesson simulation. In principle, what you need much longer simulation times already for such relatively small RNA structures as RNA nanorings, which can attain 330 nucleotides. While this full molecular dynamics simulation allowed us to obtain some insight about RNA nanoring behavior, systematic runs on the much longer durations in principle may be needed to fully explore thermal and force dynamics of the nanorings. One of the reasons basically why sort of we need longer time, of course, because we are trying, as I said before, I mean, we are trying to model the entire system where you have the water, where you have counter ions. It's really difficult to do. And one of the reasons you have around 300,000 atoms of water surrounding the nano rings plus counter ions, but you have 10,000 atoms of the RNA nano rings itself. Now, you may say, okay, there is a simple solution. You could use implicit solvent. But the chelated ions cannot be simulated in this way. So there is a problem here if you would like to account also for counter ion. And again, you know, this is something that we want to explore, a cross-grain model for this system. After, of course, you cannot do that before you do full molecular dynamics simulation. If you look at coarse-grain model development, which is, as I said, needed simply because it makes sense to simulate the structure for longer time, you have a major difficulty here because, on the one hand, you know, the very reason for coarse-grain simulation is to have a simpler model. But can you actually do that? Because there are a number of constraints that you have to satisfy. First of all, you would like to represent adequately structure of the RNA in the ring. You want to represent adequately its dynamic, its interaction with the solvent and again counter ions, and I indicated that there are problems there. And ultimately, which is much more sort of ambitious task, melting assembly to and from building blocks. Now, the comment that I would like to make here, which I think quite important for us to understand basically this fairly complex biological structure, is that this specific RNA, for example, hexa-ring, and this is true for other similar structures, consists of only 330 base pairs. However, they arrange in particular well-defined structure. So the simple energetic models that we know work in many cases quite well for randomly arranged biopolymers, for example, are not likely to work here. In particular, experimentally important differences in behavior have been found for the hexaring with different base pair sequences. So the very simple question that you may ask before you sort of proceed with this coarse grain model construction, shall the coarse grain model be sequence specific? Or shall the coarse grain model be biased towards the native structure? I mean, these questions are largely open. But the important point, as I said, what we have to understand, and this is something that we have to understand, especially, for those of us like myself who sort of moved to this biology area from more like material science mechanics area, where many things you could sort of apply certain ideas, like, for example, biopolymers, which are randomly sort of arranged. Here, it's not the case. These base pair are arranged in a particular well-defined structure, and this is important to understand. So you cannot basically derive any meaningful model before you do this full atom molecular dynamic simulation. Then you have to try to fit some parameters, which, in the remaining time, I'll try to highlight. Now, what choices do you have? There are a number of choices in the literature. The simplest case, of course, you can see the one bit model, single bit pair nucleotide centered at P. And you could sort of, there are a number of approaches. Now, for example, elastic network models, so where bits connected with elastic springs. This model can represent small scale motion around reference, namely native structure, but major drawback is no transferability to other structures. So if for the rest of my life I'm going to concentrate on this, RNA nanoring, it's probably a possible solution, but, the number of structures that we'd like to explore is much larger. So probably it's not the best solution. Now, it has been known for quite a while, so so-called GO-like models, or Dave Sirimalai from University of Maryland basically also developed similar models, which he called self-organized polymer, where bits interaction with both bonded and non-bonded potential. Here, the problem here is that we have just two energy scales, native and non-native. And major drawback is that the models here bias towards reference native structure. And of course, the model itself here, real multi-scale model. It's not just two scale that you could sort of deal with. Very interesting approach basically was proposed by Tazzini and similar by McCarran, where bits interacting with bonded and unbonded forces. The model comparatively simple, but there is no reference to the native structure included into the model. One of the drawbacks, possibly less precise structure description, but at this stage, we do believe that this basically has quite substantial potential in the application to this RNA nanostructure that I'm talking about. Now, major drawbacks for all of this is essentially no electrostatics, no counter ions taken into account. And you know that if I do full scale molecular dynamic simulations, exactly these counter ions present major problems. So, just give you I have few more minutes, just give you a very brief outlook what you should expect when you attempt to develop coarse grain models in this field. So ingredient one, of course, you have to account for connectivity term. For example, bond angle, dihedral, or something equivalent. And you could try down the structure like that. For example, here is an example given for this N2, N3, and N4 stands for nearest, and next nearest neighbors along the RNA single strand chain. This is fine, but there is a problem here which we have not resolved at the moment. It's not clear, shall we set this R0 that you see here, R0, be a single parameter, like for example in Tazzini models, or it should include the full reference to the set of distances found in the native structure, like in GO model or what Dave has proposed. And essentially, your model would be very sensitive to the choice, to the parameterization of this R naught, which is of course an issue. The other ingredient here that you have to take care of is interaction stabilizing the native fault. This is sort of a possible choice that we are exploring. The trick here is essentially, again, due to Tozzini, which sort of whose model we like, is the used distance-dependent strands of the interaction, for example, like this. And also, you could sort of play with this situation. You could take into account with the simple modification, sort of when unzipping of the molecule is allowed, or to prevent unzipping, and sort of you could play with this. The next two ingredients, as I mentioned before, that none of those previous models essentially include, is essentially electrostatic. And again, it's pretty tempting to use implicit solvent, but which is fine for water, has been used for many, many years, but it's not that obvious for counter-ions, which, as a conclusion of our full atom molecular dynamic simulations, play a very, very essential role. So you cannot ignore that. The other thing is evolution equations for the coarse-grained model, so Langevin or possibly Brownian dynamics. We, as you've seen before, based on molecular dynamic simulation, we do believe that we have to use Langevin. Parameter settings is sort of the last ingredient, but there are a few points here to mention. What you do here, you plot a radial distribution function as a function of distance from the structure itself, and then the effective potential for the interaction between the beads can be obtained from this formula based on this radial distribution function, which is plotted basically here. So the total effective potential that you extract from that formula essentially would look like that for the situation that we currently are working with. And basically the very final comment that I would like to give in this talk, again, there are several groups that are pushing essentially a force matching method, and this is perfectly fine, but the point is here that it should be used in conjunction with full molecular dynamic simulation. And of course there are other sort of possible choices, and if some of you may have some suggestions, I would be very happy to hear them. Now, conclusions. First of all, what has been observed here, strong effect of counter-ions on hexarrange structures and its stability. Based on the developed methodology, we analyzed some of the important properties of the nanorings, such as heat capacity and elastic property. We observed a phenomenon of the evaporation of the ions from the ring upon decrease of the temperature, and provided possible explanations. We called it self-stabilizing mechanism for the nanorings, which probably quite generic mechanism for structures like this. Also force dynamics of the nanorings allows us to estimate some of its transport property, for example, mobility. While the reliable estimations of the elastic property require much longer simulation time. Just to give you sort of a flavor what you are looking for here, the simulation of the properly solvated nanorings that you've seen in this talk takes about 40 hours for one nanosecond on 32 processes. And you know, as you understand, this is the reason why I spent sort of last 10 minutes talking about coarse-grained models here. Of course, sort of we acknowledge the support some people, and of course, Southwestern Ontario is quite lucky having ShockNet, a computing facility that combines computing facilities of all major universities in Southwestern Ontario. We're also grateful to Sarah Woodson, who is experimentalist from Johns Hopkins, for a number of useful comments, and our funding agencies. So if you'd like sort of to see what else we are doing, so this is the link, and thank you very much for your attention.